This long-lasting battle for the Labour leadership has all the attraction and interest of Blair's farewell tour. Labour are a pointless organisation, kept afloat by benefit junkie, poor me's and saloon socialists without the sense my dog was born with. So who really cares which loser wins? They have as much hope of leading the country as the aforementioned dog. And that was our Rant of the Week by Steve Ipswich from the Daily Telegraph website. Thank you for that interesting insight. Hello and welcome to Soapbox Radio, recording on Tuesday 24th of August 2010. I'm Stephen Wan, co-editor of the Daily Soapbox. With me is David Webber, editor of the Daily Soapbox, and guests James Callum Johnson and James Langford. Now before we start, exciting news that David Cameron has a new baby girl given birth today at 6 stone 1 ounce.
That's his wife who's given birth, not him.
That is true. Okay, so today we're starting with Dragon's Corner, so let's see what James Langford has for us today. Langford, your 60 seconds begins now.
My dearest friends, my idea today to make the world a better place is to reform our benefit system. Yet again, we've had a ludicrous story this week. A lady having her 12th child while living off our benefits. This is something which we are all paying for. Something we shouldn't be paying for. Something we need to change. I propose to scrap all benefits for anyone who is not working and have an endless number of children. To make this work, we must scrap all benefits, full stop. We'll save the taxpayers some money. We'll change the world. Thank you.
That's it, is it?
That is.
Yeah, Stephen says, ironic that Cameron has had a daughter today, then. It is an irony, isn't it? It's also more than two children, which means that he's giving a net contribution to the UK population growth rather than a neutral contribution. But still, I don't think we need to worry ourselves too much with that. After all, what's three children compared with 12 children? Stephen, what do you make of that proposal?
So if I understand this correctly, we are just cutting benefits off.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure who's that meant to help, apart from the rich.
I'm a taxpayer. I'm the economy.
I'm not sure how would it help the economy if there was social unrest?
Oh, there won't be social unrest, my dear friend.
Won't there? You seem very confident.
Oh, yes, I am. I'm confident that people will be forced to find a job.
You see, forced to find a job, that presupposes that sufficient jobs exist to just be offered these people.
I'm sure that sufficient jobs exist. And I'm sure if sufficient jobs didn't exist in this country, we have this wonderful European Union, which will allow our great people to migrate out around Europe, where sufficient jobs do exist.
I'm pretty sure the countries in Europe themselves have limited employment as well, and have people seeking work. I mean, I'm not really quite sure how to go about scrutinising this, because, in fairness, I don't think there's a lot of meat on the bones here. I mean, I will say that certainly, since the introduction of more free market policies, since Thatcherism, unemployment has been higher. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but I do think it's a little unfair to expect even more people to find jobs without any support nowadays. I don't think you will find that unemployment is lower when government has no role in the economy. The evidence exists that there is an optimum level of unemployment, which you should know yourself, James, as you're studying political economy, aren't you?
Frictional and seasonal unemployment will, of course, always exist, but people can still support themselves through that. What shouldn't exist is long-term unemployment.
The advantage being, of course, your scheme is that anyone without a job will eventually starve and die, and so we have a process of natural selection in our society once again.
You know, yes. That is... Have you ever seen a show called The New Statesman, James?
No, I haven't, my friend.
Because you sound alarmingly similar to the principal character of that, who's called Sir Alan Bastard. Now, I'll try, Stephen, you talk for the time being, but I'm going to try and find a famous quote by him on the subject of the NHS, which is very similar to what you're saying about the benefit system.
Okay, well, where to begin with this? Don't you see any problem when you've got a large family with 12 children and you essentially cut the benefits off and you tell the parents to go off and find work, how exactly are they going to raise those 12 children whilst they're out getting a job?
Those 12 children will be in school all day. There will be siblings older than the other siblings, thus the siblings can take care of the younger ones.
But what happened to this whole idea of a strong, stable family, one that looks after the children?
Strong, stable family is set by a parent giving an example. Parents are around in the evenings. They won't be working, you know, 7 day weeks, 12 hours a day, etc.
They will be trying to support 12 children.
Well, maybe they should have thought about that before they had 12 children.
What if it was a dozen triplet?
Yeah, but yeah, chances of that, my friend, are very, very low.
Low, but not impossible, you have to agree.
Okay, so you found one anomaly, but that parent's going to have to work extra hard. Bearing in mind, we're likely to have a two-parent family here.
I'm sorry, but where's this scintillating political analysis you used to be famous for, James? I mean, I'm reminded very much of our time in politics class together when we watched Columbine... Actually, what was it called? That famous Michael Moore film about gun control. Two of the parents were... No, one parent. It's a single-parent family. And this parent was doing a 10-hour work day under the American minimum wage and travelling 2 hours each way. So effectively being 14 hours a day away from her home. Now, if you have even a small family, because you're not just talking about families with 12 children, you said that you would abolish all benefits. So if you've got a small family, where's the parent going to be?
You know what, Dave? You've inspired me with a new idea to make the world a better place. Why don't we only give benefits to families which already have parents working, if they still need them? Haven't we ever thought of that idea before?
We have. But the fact is that under the existing benefit system, it's already a requirement that you find work. The difficulty is actually finding work and B, making sure people find work. And this is an idea which is not new under the sun at all. And the reason it's never actually been seriously implemented is because the social consequences would be too severe.
No, Dave, I'm afraid I disagree with both your principles. I know people on benefits. People who are perfectly capable of getting jobs and are too lazy to do it.
So do I.
Because
I also
they don't
know
have the incentive.
So do I.
Because benefits are too high.
Benefits are not too high. One could say that pay is too low. But I know people who are on benefits who are also perfectly reasonable citizens, but I don't extrapolate from that everyone who is on benefits is a reasonable citizen who wants to work. I mean, you can't say you know these people, therefore everyone is like them. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of rich people who don't do any good to society, but I wouldn't say that was a general rule about rich people, would I?
No, but they're not doing any harm to society either, which is the difference. These people are harming our economy.
No, there are perfectly good examples of rich people harming our economy. For example,
yes, but that's another matter altogether.
Oh, is it?
Yes,
what,
it is.
For the rich, one rule for the poor, eh?
James, do you know how much did the financial crash cost the economy compared to benefit scroungers?
The financial crash was not caused by rich people.
It was caused by very rich businesses who were run
by
very wealthy people.
No single individuals.
No, it was who were very wealthy.
So we associate, there were some very unwealthy people helping out with the financial crash as well in these businesses.
I don't see how. I don't honestly think that you can lay the blame for the financial crash at the desk workers and temps who were on sort of £20,000 a year type of salaries, which do exist in the financial sector, but you can certainly blame it on people who were very wealthy and who weren't going to suffer for the...
You can increase the blame, you can increase the burden of blame, but you can't put it all there.
You can't put all the blame for society's problems on benefits scroungers either, so we're just going around in circles.
Of course we can't. No, of course we can, but this is one particular problem which we could solve.
It wouldn't be solved the way you're proposing.
No, which is why I reformed my idea and said let's only give benefits to people who are working.
But why do people who are working need benefits? I'm going to bring James Callum Johnson here. He's been very, very patient. So, It's your turn.
I think James's point does have a certain party political affiliation to it, but where I see it, I can support it so far as that if you do have more people working, which is obviously it'd also be a good thing for, you know, many different economic reasons. I've always thought that England's become a very consumerist country, and I always find that we should aim to reduce the amount of migrant workers we have in this country. The simple reason that you can produce a level of stagnation within a certain, you know, a certain number of people, and then if people aren't used to working, what happens when we have to work? What happens when the oil runs out, for example? We have to produce things ourselves. What if the British people aren't ready to work? So I'm in support of anything that increases the load of people that, you know, need to work. Because at the moment, some people, as James rightly pointed out, they don't need to work. It's much easier, and they get more money by not working. And that surely can't be right.
Well, this whole idea about what if the British people, or we run out of natural resources and the British people aren't ready to work and all of that, I think it's a slightly retrograde way of thinking, considering we're part of a massive economic bloc called the European Union, considering how integrated nations, countries are becoming. Why are we looking at this insular national interest policy? Why can't we think about this on a more multinational scale? What's this whole special thing about the British people, the British economy, that's so much more important than having an integrated multinational one?
I think you misunderstand what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is everyone will need to start chipping in again soon, I think. I think that we should all be working. I think we should all... I don't want... I use the British people because I think that's what's happening to British people, but I don't want any country in the world to have a population where they are becoming very stagnant, very lazy, very... Because a lot of countries in the European Union, as you pointed out, they do work very hard, and I respect those countries a lot more than other countries. For example, some states in America where majority of the population, they become very lazy, stagnant people. And I much respect a nation of people that are ready to work. And if we become a country that isn't ready to work, if it's not used to working, then we're going to suffer in the future.
Well, Stephen had a very interesting solution to the problem of the lack of incentives to find work, which I must say I think is a lot more interesting than James's idea. Why don't you go ahead and tell us all about it, Stephen?
I'm pretty sure we've talked about this every week on this podcast now, don't we?
No, we didn't talk about it last week, so...
No, we did the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, but I think it is very relevant.
Okay, well, my idea, which isn't innovative or new or anything like that, is having a universal basic income. And this would involve giving every person of working age in this country, say, £10,000 a year from the government, completely free, no conditions attached, apart from perhaps one for community service or attending certain educational classes. And what this does is this ensures an incentive for everyone to go to work, the same level of incentive, because everyone is receiving these benefits, and these benefits aren't taken away should you go into work.
What do you think about that, James?
Yeah, that's... I don't mind that idea.
So would you be more... Would you accept that as a compromise between getting rid of all benefits and the real world?
Yeah, I mean... we can give some people some benefits to help them if they're in work, as I've said, as I've indicated.
But no, this is the idea here is that you give everyone a basic benefit, a basic income, and then if people find work, they earn twice as much as that because they've already got the benefits. So there's a huge incentive to work.
I've no time for that.
Why not?
Because we're running up yet more costs.
Well, in fact, if you think about all the costs of scrapping all the administration or virtually all of this in the benefits system, it might prove not that different a cost to the current cost of the benefits system.
I'm sure it would, David, considering the size of our population. I know bureaucracies are expensive, but they're not that expensive, dear friend.
But think about the benefits to the economy. Think about it. You create huge incentives to work whilst eliminating any form of poverty. The economy booms. It's all made back in increased revenue to the exchequer.
I'm not sure your analysis is right there.
Okay, well, I think we're not really going to find any more agreement here. So we're going to move on now to what we're reading and where we just talk about random things of interest which have caught our eyes in the last week. Stephen, do you want to start?
Well, as opposed to what I've seen in the last week, I will tell you about a book I've bought the other day in Oxfam. I found this for $2.99, and it's called The State We're In by Will Hutton. I don't know if you've heard of this book. It was written in 1995, I think. And it's just after the sort of whole Thatcherite revolution, just a couple of years before Blair's been elected. But just reading the first chapter, it's very interesting to read the sort of problems it's talking about. Because it talks about the number of people on benefits, how the banks have ruined the economy because we're too investment orientated, and it's striking how little is different from today and how this could well have been written 15 years later and still be as relevant. So what do people think about how much you've changed since 15 years ago?
In terms of politically, not much, not really. In terms of sociological revolution since New Labour, big time. But the basic fundamental problems, of course, are still the same because human nature hasn't evolved.
Sociological change in what way would you say?
Well, in terms of, for example, banking culture.
That's changed a lot, has it?
No, it hasn't at all. That's what's not changed. In terms of what has changed, we have this whole new generation. I mean, we've already alluded to it. We've got these benefit frauds. We've got these, what do they call them, newts, not in work or education. These teenagers who just run around council estates in gangs and shoot each other for fun. We've got a culture now of laziness. We've lost our manners. We've lost that sort of Britishness which we once had. And that's all come around with New Labour.
I'm struggling to be convinced by that. So I'm pretty sure there were people who cheated the benefit system and that gangs existed back in the 1990s. I mean,
you're right, David, you're right, but it's now endemic.
What are you basing that on?
Just the way that, for example, to use one example, Newton Farm in Hereford, a housing estate, used to be quite a respectable place in the 90s. Since New Labour got in, it had a great time. It went through this revolution, it got the money, etc. The people changed, the council's housing changed. Everything about it became less attractive to live in. And you've just now, as I say, you've got gangs.
Can I just reply to James there?
Yes.
I think it's quite striking how you used that farm as an example. I think it's quite important that we need to state the fact that under both eras of Newton Farm's existence, as you've laid out, there was still a Conservative council that dealt with those two periods. So surely if any change were to have occurred...
Sorry, no, it wasn't Johnson. It was a Lib Dem council before, and then a Conservative council. And
it's deteriorated since the Conservative council has been...
Yeah, but it's not to do with the council, Johnson. It's to do with the national agenda as set by a Labour government.
Well, I think a council has a lot more jurisdiction over what it does than you think. And surely it could have done something about it if it was perceived to be a problem.
I just think it's interesting that you're choosing to blame New Labour for this. When you consider, so fourth paragraph into The State We're In by Will Hutton in 1995, after a good 16 years of Conservative government, one in four males of working age are either officially unemployed or idle, with incalculable consequences for our well-being and social cohesion. This problem began under Thatcher, not Labour.
James, I'm also struck by the fact that prior to 1997, there were even fewer in-work benefits than there are today. As you know, in-work benefits enjoyed a huge boost through Gordon Brown's tax credit system. So, in fact, there are many more people on in-work benefits than on out-of-work benefits today.
Not in Southside Hereford.
Yeah, but we're talking, as you said, about the national agenda. I'm sure are exceptions, but in terms of the national agenda, I don't think you can deny that there are there's now much more focus on benefits in work as well as out of work.
Fantastic, David. But the type of people who focus on those are people like you and me who understand them. We've left a whole generation of citizens behind in this country. We've abandoned them.
Yeah,
we have. And I'm not saying it's some, I don't know where we've left them, I don't know how we've left them, but they are gone. And now they are a nuisance to every part, not just our economy, our society as well, and our culture.
But you always get people, you've always got people left behind in every single period of our history. The difference is today that you're less likely to starve as a result of it, or to be brutally murdered as a result of it than you were in ages past. I think that is genuinely a bit of progress for you.
Anyway, shall we move on to the next what we've been reading? James Callum Johnson, do you have anything that you've been particularly interested in this week?
Well, I'm always on the lookout for some new reading material. And, I'm a very big J.R. Tolkien fan. And I bought the Lord of the Rings books a year ago now, and I haven't had the heart to read them because they're so bloody long. But I've embarked on the first one now, so it's taken me a while actually because it's one of those things where you have to give yourself enough time to start because I don't want to read part of it and then have to leave it. So, and I love all of his work. I mean, I've got a whole shelf full of the stuff, so it's not like I'm, you know, it's just more the same for me really. But I love it, and it's quite interesting because a foreword in the new edition of Lord of the Rings, it talks about how a lot of people wrote things at the time and still now, that Lord of the Rings is actually a metaphor for the Great War, for World War 1 and 2, when, of course, J.R.R. Tolkien was alive and reading and writing his books. But actually, there's an insert from J.R.R. Tolkien, which never actually got published in any national newspapers, that talks about how none of it was to do with the war at all, and that... And all the police political and sociological attachments they tried to attach to the book in the, when people were discussing it in the wider popular culture were actually completely ill-founded, and that most of it was actually based on his own life and the relationship he had with it was in his own family and things like that. So I thought that was rather interesting because I'd always assumed that these writings on his work were all true, you know. Of course he was, you know, writing in relation to the war or something, but a lot wasn't, so I thought that was really interesting. I don't know if you want to discuss your own readings or...
Well, you remind me of something there, actually, because there's a famous piece of music, well, only famous to people who go to my college, that we studied last year, called Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, which... the composer only actually gave it that title because his publisher advised him to, and it wasn't originally written about Hiroshima at all. But that begs the question, does it change, you know, the value of it as a threnody to the victims of Hiroshima? If no one had known that, would the music have been different? I mean, this is all a bit sort of metaphysical and thus, prone to go around in circles. But I do think it's interesting how diverse the reactions a work of art can inspire in others.
I agree. But I think a lot... Sorry, go on.
Okay. I always thought Lord of the Rings was just a metaphor for the 1980s and Thatcher's terrible policies.
What, the New York to the cabinet, or...?
It's a bit of a late metaphor. Wasn't Tolkien... No, Tolkien probably was still alive then, wasn't he? But
He died in... Oh, God. I should know this. I think it's 1978.
Oh, no, yeah. So, in fact, Tolkien died before his work could be applied to such political ends as Stephen has just...
It was clearly a premonition, like George Orwell's 1984.
Oh, so you think that New Labour have really been the dystopian state, Big Brother state, that everyone accuses them of being, do you?
Not quite that far, but...
But he was visionary, was he?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I myself have been reading Martin Bell's memoirs this week, which are surprisingly readable. I didn't expect to find it all that interesting, but it is quite interesting, actually. It's very fun to read his observations about political figures of the day, particularly Tony Blair and Neil Hamilton, etc. Blair's in particular, I'm sure that James Langford wouldn't enjoy reading it, because he's not particularly enamoured with Blair as a politician, or as a person.
Blair as a person and Blair as a politician, two very different things. One very likeable, one not.
Sorry, which ones are you talking about?
I'm just musing on what you just said, Mr. Webber. I'll tell you what, my mind drifted into, I've never really thought about it before, but Blair as a person and Blair as a politician are two very different people.
Of course, but which one's the more likeable?
Oh, Blair as a person.
Which one's the better? Which one's the more effective?
Blair as a politician.
But Bell seems to think that there's no point in winning landslides if you don't use them to any good end. What do you think about that?
Blair, I agree. Blair used his to perfectly good ends.
Despite New Labour creating this culture of dystopia in the United Kingdom, full of gangs and benefit scroungers and the like.
Oh, well, okay, so he used them to certain ends. On a foreign scale, he used it to great benefit. On a domestic scale, he may have missed a few things.
That's interesting. I think a lot of people would say the opposite.
Yeah, well, it depends how you view international welfare and intervention.
I have to say that even if you take the view that Iraq hasn't been any worse off as a result of the invasion, which is a perfectly legitimate view to take, despite that, I think it has to be said that it's certainly a textbook example of mistakes you should not make when you invade another country, such as dismissing the army without pay, for example, upon conquering it. That's
I'm sure that's a conversation for another day, Mr. Webber.
Yes, I think it is. We're about to approach our 30-minute ceiling, so I think we should call it a day here. So this is David Webber signing off.
Stephen Wan, bringing it to an end.
James Langford, thank you for having me.
And James Callum Johnson, thank you for having me too.